Your latest release, Arigato Japan, is a 4-CD Japanese import box set. Indeed, you've got several tunes on it, which are salutes to that nation. Please tell us more about it.
You're talking about the 5-CD set that was put out already? With my picture on the front?
I believe so.
Yeah, well, you know, the very first CD in that 5-CD box set are my vocals. You know, I had a contract with Imperial Records early in the 60s, and they kind of took me for granted. I had some breakouts here and there that they really didn't follow up on. And the rest of it are some of the songs that I chose that I thought would, you know, be appropriate for a 5-CD set. So, yeah, that's doing very well, incredibly well, as the record company is telling us. Now, we have another one. This is Pony Canyon Company that's putting that one out, or did put it out. And it's been out during the time that we were there last summer. And, this last summer of this year, you know. And actually, Universal it is now. First it was Toshiba, and then it went to somebody else, like Capital or something like that. Now it's Universal, but they are putting out a 10-set CD of the Ventures coming up pretty soon, yeah.
Is this new material, old material, or both?
Old, oh yeah, it's all compilation.
Stuff from the 60s on out?
Yeah.
Cool, yep. Way cool.
And you know, I don't know that anybody is aware of this, but we've had 20 number one hits in Japan.
I'm aware that you've done very, very well in Japan.
No doubt about it. And some of the melodies, you know, after we were there for a few years, you know, let's say we started over there in 1962, and then, you know, went there every year, 2-3 times a year. We were so popular. We're like the Beatles. You couldn't go out of your hotel. Anyway, around 68 or something like that, we started to really understand what the Japanese music they liked. And a lot of it's done in a minor key, and a lot of things that we do is in a minor key also. So we started writing songs, especially aimed at Japan. And not only did we have 5 number one hits instrumentally, but then they started writing words for those melodies, and they all went to number one too.
Do you mean people covering your tunes?
No, it's the same record company that put out our, you know, Toshiba at the time, record company that put out our those instrumentals. And so they got Japanese singers to sing it in Japanese. So I wouldn't call that a cover.
I see. Let's go back a little. You got your first guitar when you were in the Army in the early 1950s. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I learned, my mom had any aficionado of stringed instruments would know what this is, but it was called a tipple, like a T-I-P-P-L-E, but it's tuned like a ukulele, but it has 10 strings, and you know, they're octaves. Some wound and some not. And it had a very full sound, and my mom showed me a few chords on it, and that's how I actually started to play any stringed instrument. And then I happened to meet a guy that, you know, just locally, that knew a few chords on the guitar, And he and I used to get together, me with a tipple and him with a guitar. And so, you know, what I did at that time was try to, you know, I figured I should be playing a guitar with a guitar. So that's how I started, is I bought a guitar, you know, like I think it was a Silver Tone from Sears. It was probably about, at that time, about $50 or $60, which was all the money in the world at that time. You know, that's in like 1950. I went in the Army in 53, so it had to be about 51 or 52 that I bought my first guitar.
I see. How did you meet your eventual bandmate, Bob Bogle?
You know, he and I were two construction workers. It's a real long story. I was selling cars, and I was a terrible salesman. I was on a commission, and I just wasn't making it because, you know, I mean, God, I'm not saying that used car dealers are dishonest, but I was really honest to a fault for making money. I mean, if somebody came in and I really liked them and, you know, learned to talk, I mean, I started talking to them and I learned to really like them, and they would point out a car, and the boss there always said, sell the worst car in the lot, get rid of them. That's where our profit is, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If somebody pointed out a car and I liked them, I said, nah, you don't want that car. I knew how every car in the lot either had problems or didn't, or slight problems or whatever. So Bob, a guy came in one time, and I really had a good rapport with him, and his name was Bob Bogle. And I told him, you know, he pointed out a car, and I told him, you don't want that car. But I did turn him on to a car that I said is in real good condition, and I think you really like it. And I don't know how far you go back, but it was a Hudson. They don't make them anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But it really ran good. And so he bought that. And then, you know, he made, once he made a little bit more money, then he came in and bought a real upscale Chevrolet at that time. You know, like early 50s Chevrolet. I mean, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s Chevrolet. So that's how I met him. And I said to him, you know, I'm not doing very well here selling cars. What do you do? He says, well, I'm in the concrete business, you know, the masonry restoration. And that means that the concrete that is between the bricks, that fails. It gets dried out, and you have to grind it out and put new concrete in it, new cement. And that's what we were doing. And I asked him, and that's what he was doing, and I asked him, is there any chance that you could find me a job there? And he said, well, I'll sure try. And a couple of months later, he came in and said, hey, I got you a job. And I said, really? Oh, that's great. So I went to work for the same company he went to work for, but I didn't work with him for a couple of months. And he and I bought two guitars once we did get together. You know, we found out that each one of us, you know, played a few chords on a guitar, and, you know, so we went out and bought a couple of guitars in a pawn shop in Tacoma, Washington. That's where I was born and grew up. And he happened to be living in that same area. So we bought two guitars in a pawn shop that probably cost about $15 a piece. I mean, the strings were about half an inch away from the neck, just terrible guitars, but I mean, to have a couple of guitars was great. And it had what they call a de-armand pickup, and you could play it through an amplifier if you put that on there. So you put that under the strings, and you know, it had a wire to it that went to an electric to an amplifier. You could plug it into an amplifier. God, we were in heaven playing through an amplifier. So he and I, as it would be, we worked together a lot out of town. And when you do a masonry restoration, if it rains a lot, you know, a heavy rain pour, you can't work because it just screws up your concrete. So we, like I said, had a lot of time on our hands, so we bought some books that had chords and where you place your fingers, and we really tried to learn the guitar in earnest, you know, really working, and you know, going back and forth from let's say that we were in Seattle, and we would go to Pullman, Washington, which was a college at the time, Washington State College. Now it's the University, you know, Washington State University. But anyway, we had a lot of time on our hands. We worked every way we could to try to learn, you know, how to play the guitar. And so when finally learned a lot of chords, and a lot of chords were minor chords, which, you know, and we were both into kind of country music where there's three or four chords, and that's about all you needed to know to sing country songs or play them. So anyway, we learned a lot more than that. And he happened to have a vinyl, of course, that's all there was at the time. Well, an album, yeah, an album, they called it an album. And he happened to have, it was Chet Atkins who he really liked, his playing. We both did. Of course, he was amazing. And he had a song on that album that was called Walk, Don't Run. And he played it with a finger style and jazzy. Well, hell, we couldn't play like that. So what we did was, you know, try to make a different arrangement of it, and, you know, with just two guitars. And so that's what we did, and that's how Walk, Don't Run came about. And we didn't know a bass player or a drummer at all. And, you know, once we did find one, a bass player, and a drummer, and went in and recorded something that failed miserably before we recorded Walk, Don't Run. And it, you know, we were a couple of construction workers with families, so we didn't have money to do much with, you know. So what we did was just saved our money, saved it until we could go in and do some recording. There was a studio in Seattle that had recorded a group called the Fleetwoods. I don't know if you remember them or not.
I do.
Yeah, okay. That's dum 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 do dum da da, you know.
That's the line.
Maybe is what it was called. But anyway, this record company in Seattle had recorded them, and they had a number one hit and a top five hit. One was called Come Softly to Me. The other one was called Mr. Blue. And so after playing in real dives, you know what I mean, beer bottles flying around, squad cars out in front to take drunks out by the nap of their necks, that's the kind of place we were playing. And of course we had some backup, like a drummer and a bass player, and so like there was four of us on stage. So we were fortunate enough to meet somebody that had been playing the guitar since he was 5 years old. And that guy's name is Noki Edwards. And he really didn't have a lot of drive. He's more of a follower than a leader. So anyway, we got a hold of him, and we were working in this club, and we were playing 4 hours a night in a tavern. It's a tavern. It's not a club. I don't like to call them a club because it's just a beer tavern, wine, beer, where they sit there and, you know, pass out at the bar, you know, one of those places. So anyway, we asked him if he would join us, and we were only getting like $15 a night, you know, a piece. And so we said, we can't, you know, we'll split what we get with you, because there was only the two of us playing. And when we started playing, people said to us, well, how did you get your sound? It's different. Well, when I bought a guitar, we both bought guitars. We didn't know a bass player, like I said. We didn't know a drummer. I played a very percussive rhythm to make up for the drums. And he played, when it came to a one note, he'd play a chord and use that whammy bar quite a bit, you know, to make a, you know, like a vibrato. And when we did get a bass player and a drummer, that stuck. And we didn't know any other way to play. And people were saying, you know, we went into record Walk Don't Run finally, because when we were playing in these places, used to be a lot of people come up and say, what was that song you just played? Well, it's called Walk Don't Run. Can you play it again? We really like it. And so we decided we'd go in and record it. So we went in and recorded it, and probably, you know, saved enough money to where we could go in and record it. So we did. And now, here we are, 270 albums later, and over 110 million sales for a couple of ex-construction workers. That's pretty good. And there were people coming up to us, other bands, and say, you're going to go in and play without a saxophone or without a piano or a keyboard? You're not going to get anywhere with just, you know, two guitars, a bass, and a drum. And thank God, as it turned out, we didn't know anybody, you know. And so that's why it's only four pieces. We didn't know anybody that played. And so we used to do these talent shows that weren't really talent shows. They were popularity shows. The more people you had in there, you won from applause. And we started winning with not knowing anybody in the place. And, you know, that's how they got, you know, people to come in for a talent show. I'm trying to keep this straight and kind of, you know, exactly how it went at that time, one thing after the other, the recollection. That's a long time ago. So anyway, we did do Walk, Don't Run. And my mom just loved what we played. She loved it. And she wanted to be part of it, so I said, well, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're working every day. If you can take this Walk, Don't Run that we recorded around the radio stations, and we'll try it too. And she said, yeah, I can do that. You can't imagine how many times we were turned down with Walk, Don't Run. Hindsight is so common. You know, when you hear Walk, Don't Run, you say, people turned that down? Yeah, they did. Radio stations said, no, that's not a hit. We don't want to play that. So anyway, we got it played as what they call a news kicker on the top 40 station. We happened to know somebody that came from a smaller station and joined this station here. It's called KJR, and it's still going. But anyway, that was the top 40 station. So I said to the guy that we had befriended from another station that went to KJR and asked him if he could put that on their list. And he said, well, I'm not the program director. I can't do that. So I said, oh, well, okay. So he had called later and said, you know, but maybe a week later, and said, I had talked to the program manager, and he's not crazy about what don't run, but he said, I'll tell you what, I'll tell you what I'll do. We'll use it as a, what they call a news kicker. And they had news 5 minutes before the hour. And they would play something just before the news. And when they started playing Walk Don't Run just before the news, the switchboard lit up. Who is that? What is that? We love it. The only people that really liked it were the people that could do us no good whatsoever. So anyway, finally, a guy from Dalton Records, his name is Bob Reisdorf, he had a group called the Fleetwoods, and a couple of other groups, you know, an instrumental group that he had here called the Frantics, and they were a bunch of college guys, and so anyway, he heard Walk Don't Run as a news kicker, and he called the station and said, who is that? I love that. That's a natural hit. We found an angel. You know, so anyway, he wanted to, you know, do business with us, and we said, yeah. He was shocked to know that we were a local group. He thought we were from California or somewhere like that because of the sound of it, like a surfing kind of sound. And so he took it on. And he said, I have a distributor in California, it's Liberty Records. He said, I'm going to send it down to them and have them release it. Well, he sent it down to them, and the president of Liberty Records said, no, I don't want it. It's not a hit. And so this Bob Reisdorf, who owned Dalton Records here in Seattle that had the Fleetwoods, he said, well, I'll tell you what, you put it out. If it loses money, I'll pay it. And it went on to be a number two hit in the nation.
Was this the edition on Blue Horizon Records?
On Blue Horizon, that's right. That was our own label that we started before we ever met Bob Reisdorf, because we had to have a record label. And so it was on Blue Horizon. I think the first time we went in was I did some impersonations, you know, on the first thing we did. Walter Brennan, especially at that time, was popular with the Real McCoys TV show. And we saved our money for that, and that didn't go anywhere. So, you know, little local stations, and when we worked in Pullman, of course, it's all bloated up to where it shouldn't be, but you know, they made it up like a top 10. So we had to give up on that and start saving our money to do Walk, Don't Run. So anyway, let me get back to sending the Walk, Don't Run down to Liberty Records. And he said, of course, like I said, no, I don't want it. It's not a hit. Bob Reisdorf said, well, if you put it off, it'll lose his money. And it went on to be number two hit in the nation. Now, it would have been easily number one. But our competition, top five, was It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley, The Twist, Chubby Checker, Only the Lonely, Roy Orbison, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Polka Dot Bikini. This was our competition in the top five. And we would go to the magazine store, they had a Billboard magazine, and see if we ever went to number one. We stayed in number two while they changed back and forth to number one. So anyway, we never have had a number one record in this country. Never have. 20 of them in Japan, but none here. So anyway, but it was enough to really perk up the ears of wannabe guitar players, garage bands. And they called us the band that launched 1,000 guitar bands. So anyway, the final, we start selling albums like crazy because the young guitar players or the wannabe guitar players would buy our albums and try to copy our style. So we sold, we were at one time responsible for 25% of all of the Liberty Records sales.
That's and impressive. Volume.
Yeah. And so things just, you know, kind of skyrocketed. And we had five albums on the charts at one time. Somewhere around 1962 or three.
You and your bandmates were contemporaries of other rock instrumentalists like Link Wray, Duane Eddy, and The Shadows. How did they influence your sound?
Well, I was a big Duane Eddy fan. Oh, my gosh. You know, I mean, his stuff was very commercial sounding, but simple. You know, his melodies were simple, his chords were simple, but his arrangements were great. And so he was my idol at that time, Duane Eddy. And, of course, Noki Edwards, that had been playing guitar forever since he was 5 years old, his idols were Chet Atkins and Les Paul and people like that. They were way too complicated for us to try to play like that. So we were lucky enough to find Noki Edwards and make him a part of the Ventures group. And then we used about five different drummers, you know, and one of them that we got, this story is good too. We used a guy named Skip Moore, asked him if he would come in and record, you know, Walk Don't Run, because he had played it, you know, I don't know how many times at talent shows with us. And he had a little different style. And so we asked him if he would come in and play it. And he said, okay. And then Noki played the bass, and my partner, Bob Bogle, played the lead, and I played rhythm. So Skip Moore, we asked him, you know, we'll give you a fourth of whatever the record makes or $25. And you know what he took. He took the $25. And now, after I thought about it for a while, he's probably been approached with people saying, well, we'll give you a fourth of this or some of this, and it never made anything, and he never made any money. So he wasn't going to take a chance this time, so he took the $25. And then we asked him if he wanted to go on the road with us, and he said, no, he doesn't want to do that. So we got a guy named Howie Johnson.
This is a drummer you're talking about, right?
Drummers, yeah. So we got Howie Johnson, and he went out on the road with us for about a year, and he had gotten in a car accident and really hurt his back. And if we got on a bumpy road, boy, he'd be going, ow, ow, you know, so he had to quit. He couldn't do it. And then anyway, we had already moved to Los Angeles, and we went to a famous country kind of bar, tavern, that held about 500 people, actually. And the drummer they had was named Mel Taylor. And so we didn't have a drummer, and we said, would you be interested in you know, joining up with us? And he said, yeah, he would. So he was with us until he passed on in 1996. So that's how this whole thing came about. And now it's 270 albums later. You know, I even have a gold 8-track. Who has that?
Wow.
So anyway, and then over 110 million sales. For a couple of construction workers, you know, if we hadn't met Noki Edwards, we probably would have been about a five-album artist, and that would have been the end of it. But he was so good, and And we happened to really gel together. So that's how that whole thing came about and how it happened. Now, I've been going to Japan since 1962, and this year is my... I just said I can't do it anymore. And so I semi-retired. I can't travel. I want to record with Adventures, but I just can't travel anymore. I plan on writing songs. I went there 53 years in a row without missing any concerts. And this last time, I just, you know, this last summer, I was hoping I was going to get through the whole thing. And they made a big deal out of my, you know, so-called retirement. And they did very, very well with merchandise and things like that. So anyway, now I am, you know, like, I would say I'm pretty much retired. And so what I have done is to try to get other groups and record them. And, you know, I want to stay in the business, but I just can't travel anymore. My next birthday, I'll be 83 years old.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So, well, I hope you can congratulate me again in about 5 years.
I do too.
Yeah, so anyway, that's how everything got started, and that's how it I ended anyway, was just to say I can't do it anymore. And this last summer, I was hoping that I would get through the thing, you know, because having a heavy guitar on, you know, for 55 years strapped on you kind of screwed up my back. And anyway, so that's where it is right now. But we've had so many, I don't want to miss this either, we've had so many honors in Japan. I have something called the Northwest Asian Weekly, and the headlines say, "The Ventures earn one-of-a-kind recognition from Japan's emperor."
Whoa.
And before that happened, the government honored us. And the only rock and roll group ever in 150 years of cultural exchange were the only rock group ever. It was always, you know, like symphony orchestras or doctors or that were honored by the government, scientists and things like that. So it was quite an honor to be chosen by the government. So there's two honors from Japan that are just incredible.
That really is amazing.
It really is. The Ventures are a total phenomenon. And we happen to be, unfortunately, the Rodney Dangerfields of the rock world. We just don't get no respect. And I don't know why.
I don't know why either. I keep on seeing copies of your records pop up at record fairs, thrift shops, you name it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Mr. Wilson, thank you very much and have a great day.
Well, thank you. You too.
Thanks to Doc Sonic and Jacob Thompson for assistance.